Right now, Levi's jeans are guaranteed in stock at Sears. Or you get a free pair. That's right, Levi's in stock or you get a free pair. So vote for me, Mark Lesden, for class president.
All jeans are now on sale in the Sears book and at Sears.com. Sears, where it begins.
We'll ship your Levi's in 5 business days or they're free. Restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer good through 8/18/07.
Once you were lost and now you're found. Or you will be after your next trip to Pep Boys when you take home a Garmin Street Pilot GPS for just $229.98 after mail-in rebate. Or grab a 3500 Surge Watts generator at Pep Boys, also just $229.98. Save $100 after mail-in rebate. Save $10 on all Pennzoil oil changes after mail-in rebate and pick up a 40-piece socket set for free after mail-in rebate. 5 days only, sale ends Sunday. Thank you for shopping at Pep Boys.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX, the official station of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
Get your weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by calling the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026, a service of Union State Bank. Now at Union State Bank, free checking, no monthly charges, no per check fees, just $100 to open at Union State Bank. Union State Bank sponsors the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026. That's 914-636-7026.
The forecast for Westchester County and the vicinity for this Thursday morning, mostly cloudy skies. A few light showers are possible, then hazy sunshine this afternoon, and we could see some strong gusty thunderstorms developing with highs into the middle 80s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, continued muggy, lows falling into the upper 60s. Mostly sunny, less humid as we move towards Friday. Highs range into the low to middle 80s. Clear and cool at night, upper 50s. Sunny weather, middle 70s on Saturday. Abundance of sunshine into the middle 70s for Sunday. Chance of rain Monday. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr., reporting for WVOX, WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center has been brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center. Right for New York.
What's right for New York? I'll tell you what's right for New York.
Nuclear power? Oh, it's right for New York, definitely.
New Yorkers, take a new look at nuclear power.
It's right for New York because nuclear power doesn't pollute the air or contribute to global warming.
I didn't know that.
It's right for New York because we make it right here.
So it's not foreign energy.
Es correcta para Nueva York. Totalmente.
Nuclear power produces homegrown electricity that's reliable.
It costs less than other sources of power. That's right for me.
And nuclear power is safe. For more than 30 years, the Indian Point Energy Center, now run by Entergy, one of the most respected and experienced nuclear operators in the country, has had an award-winning track record for safety.
It's right for New York because it means cleaner air for my family.
뉴욕에 알 맞습니다.
For other ways nuclear power is right for New York, visit the Indian Point Energy Center on the web at rightfornewyork.com. The Indian Point Energy Center.
It's right for New York.
.9:05 and time now for WVOX Westchester Traffic with Craig Shankman. Good morning, Craig.
Hey, Bob. Good morning. Thank you very much. Accident cleared away in the Bronx from the Bronx River Parkway South right by Pelham Parkway. Wrapping up an accident in northern Westchester, northbound Taconic State Parkway in Yorktown right by Underhill Avenue. Tap and see looks good. 287 East, slight delays heading into White Plains. No delays on I-95. Metro North in good shape. All lines running on time. Same for the B-line buses, no problems around Westchester. So Craig Shankman, Shadow Traffic, 1460 WVOX.
Thank you very much, Craig. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.
You got it.
Take care. It is 76 degrees under cloudy skies. Some sprinkles expected this morning here at One Broadcast Forum.
Don't miss the 2007 Barclays Golf Tournament, the first ever PGA Tour playoff event for the FedEx Cup, August 20th to the 26th at the Westchester Country Club in Harrison. Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, defending champion Vijay Singh, and the rest of the world's best are scheduled to compete. Kids 12 and under get in free with a paid adult. For tickets and information, call 877-GOLF-NYC. That's 877-GOLF-NYC or visit thebarclaysgolf.com.
There's a new wine store in town, and all of Westchester is delighted. Ralph's Wines and Spirits at 498 Forest Avenue at the corner of Playland Parkway in Rye, New York, has almost overnight become the source for fine wines and spirits in the Golden Apple. Presided over by Ralph Hersom, the personable and brilliant sommelier of the former Le Cirque and a protege of Maestro Cirio Marchionne, Ralph was one of the youngest wine directors in the country and also served as cellar master at the famed Windows on the World. And now in Westchester, he's become your personal sommelier at Ralph's Wines and Spirits in Rye. Here you'll find over 300 selections, all personally tasted and tested by Ralph, and a full range of half bottles with wine tastings from 4 to 7 every Friday and 2 to 6 every Saturday afternoon. Here at last is a wine store not dictated to by the big distributors or mass market importers. Very worthy and agreeable wine start at just $9.95 at your personal sommelier, Ralph's Wines and Spirits. Also featuring a full line of magnificent Riedel wine glasses in every appropriate size. A wine store like no other in Rye at the corner of Forest and Playland Parkway. For directions to Ralph's, call 914-921-1847. Open Monday through Saturday, 914-921-1847.
New Yorkers like playing the odds. We only look one way when crossing two-way streets.
Hey, I'm walking here!
We go over Niagara Falls in barrels.
Geronimo! Oh, no!
We even eat street food.
I'll have one of those.
What, the brown one or the gray one?
Lots of street food.
What is this?
How would I know?
Yes, New Yorkers like playing the odds, but we love beating them. So play Lucky Sum from the New York Lottery. When you play numbers or win four, play the Lucky Sum option for just a dollar more. When the sum of your numbers equals the sum of the winning numbers, you win. And Lucky Sum can improve your chance of winning to 1 in 13. Much better odds than, say, finding an affordable apartment in Manhattan.
2 months deposit. No pets, no parties, no music, no fun.
So play Lucky Sum from the New York Lottery today.
No nothing.
Hey, you never know.
From August 12th through the 18th, the New York Lottery will increase... 1460 WVOX.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel, and I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and can be also heard live streaming on www.wvox.com. One can also directly call to the station at 914-636-0110. It's on 1460 AM. Our guest this morning is Ms. Lynn Lehrman Wiener, who was accompanied by her able husband, Mr. John Wiener, who was a member of the Greatest Generation, served his country in the European theater with distinction during World War II, and returned a decorated captain. I just want to mention that because they're old friends, and he deserves to get that credit. And we've been buddies for a long time. Our guest, Miss Lynn Lehrman Wiener, and I'm going to call her Lynn, has been and remains a resident of Westchester County for many, many years. And throughout her long career, she's been a freelance writer, a reporter, a newspaper editor, a member of the White Plains Human Rights Commission, a social activist, a New York State Democratic Committee woman or person, now that's the new language, an editor and lecturer, film producer and author. She is a Renaissance woman. Lynn, whom I've known for over 35 years, is the daughter of Dr. Philip Lehrman, and she has a book called Sigmund Freud Through Lehrman's Lens. It is based on 16-millimeter amateur films, which her father, the psychoanalyst Philip Lehrman, took during his analysis with the famous Dr. Sigmund Freud from 1928 through 1929. Almost 50 years after his death and almost 80 years after a young Lynn Lehrman sat on Freud's lap, Lynn has authored a very private insight into a very private man. And Lynn has been able to open up a rare and personal view of not only one of the most famous personalities of the 20th century, one of the most important, but in the world of psychoanalysis, through her book, film, her work, and her book, she really opens up a view on the world of psychoanalysis and the lost Europe of the late 1920s. As I say each week, the mission of the advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow, etc. And so you understand the term. It is free trade versus protectionism, slavery versus emancipation, states' rights versus federalism, and maybe even the all-volunteer army versus the draft. Here, we're basically going to talk about Lynn and her book and maybe get some insights on psychoanalysis and how we got to that, and I'm sure some people will be very interested in calling about that. Dr. Lehrman, Lynn's father, was born in Russia in 1895, came to the United States at the age of 10, graduated from Fordham College Medical School in 1918. He received further training at the St. Lawrence Hospital in Ogdensburg, New York, and was one of a small group that practiced and taught psychoanalysis in this country. He was also a professor at Columbia University and NYU. And I posed to Lynn, did your father ever tell you why he was inspired to practice psychiatry, which in that day was almost an unknown medical practice?
Well, his practice was in psychiatry, but more importantly to him and to our family, in psychoanalysis. Psychiatry was known. It goes back to the ancient days of the Greek and Roman Empire knew about psychiatry. They may not have called it that term, but they were trying to figure out why people were different, why there were differences in the personality, why there were differences in reactions to the same stimuli. And it was all inside them, and people understood that very early, that these emotional reactions came from inside you, but what produced those emotional reactions was never really studied.
So in other words, they, as the science matured, people were looking for answers on either how to get it out of someone, which maybe there was the Freudian method, and you're going to go more into that, I gather, or were there physical problems that affected the mind?
Yeah, they're still trying to figure that out. There is no definitive answer at this point, except that we know this much about it. What we know now in this day and age, in the 18th century, you know, there were those who fought to free mental patients from being chained down in the hospitals, which they were for centuries even before that. And that was in itself an open-minded point of view about how to treat people who had mental ailments. To understand mental ailments, there was no science at that time that dealt with it, per se, but there were theories that were built up about how to treat a patient who suffered from these things and how to include them into the neighborhood, so to speak.
It's interesting. I had just a thought on how our society, our American society, was exposed to a lot of the craziness regarding the witches of Salem.
Oh, yes. Indeed.
And that, you know, people thought at that time that vespers and bad humors and they were the devil had come into them, and that caused this a type of craziness. And people actually associated some of the activities of these young women in Salem to eating hallucinative or hallucinogenic mushrooms, and that they had actually started to dance around and act in strange ways, and people thought they either lost their mind or were possessed. And it's sort of interesting how we've always wondered about the mysteries of the mind. And maybe that's where we're going to get into how Freud and your father started to delve into this area. A quick update on back to your father and his background. I learned that there was a Dr. A.A. Brill who was one of his mentors. How did he become associated with him, and who was he?
A.A. Brill was America's first psychoanalyst. He came here at the age of 13 with not a dime in his pocket. He lived on the floor of a bar, which he cleaned with his hand on his hands and knees, and earned a few cents, and put himself through college, and got a very thorough education. He lived in the library for the most part. He had no place to live. And the library that he chose to live in didn't throw him out. They put up with him. And he grew enormously. He had a tremendous insight into what was going on in this country. He knew about it. And he left his parents and that whole world behind him. My father met him when he was interning upstate in Ogdensburg. He came up there actually to pay a visit to the head of the hospital at the time, who turned out to be an uncle of one of John's teacher friends at Edgemont, which was a sort of interesting connection that had nothing to do with what we're talking about. But that's where Dad met Brill, and Brill took him under his wing, and he said, when you finish your internship, you're coming, where are you coming back to the city? He said, absolutely. He says, I love New York City, I'm coming back. And he did come back, and he had no place to practice, and Brill at that time was wealthy enough to have bought a brownstone house on West 71st Street, and he invited Dad to use the basement as his first office. So Dad was there for a number of years after he graduated and interned and started his practice in 1920. So Brill had an enormous influence on our lives. He was like my second father. He was an amazing, wonderful person.
And he was quite a bit older than you, than your
21
father.
21 years older.
Right.
Yes.
Now, to frame the context of Dr. Lehrman and Freud, I want to bring up something and review this for our audience. Freud, as most people know, was an Austrian neurologist and psychiatrist who co-founded the school of psychoanalytic psychology. It's best known for his theories on the subconscious mind, the mechanics of repression, and his definition of sexual desire as mobile and directed to a wide range of objects. He taught and developed the therapeutic techniques that dealt with the values of dreams, saw these in the same way as sources and insight into the unconscious desires. In this sense, what directed your father to go to Vienna and see Freud? And who enabled them to be introduced? How does a Philip Lehrman from New York City meet a Sigmund Freud in Vienna?
Well, he discovered reading Freud when he was still a senior in high school, and that was long before he met Brill. The field interested him because he was a person apparently from youth who was interested in what made other people tick. And he didn't always understand why somebody said something. They had a woman who lived with them for a while. I'm not going to go into the details of the story. But she was taken in by the family, and she was a stranger to them. And she was a very sick, mentally ill person, apparently. And my father recognized that at the age of 7. And he was determined to make a friend of hers, but she was determined not to allow him to become a friend, and she just rejected him all the time, and he never could understand what made her work. Mm-hmm. And she in many ways didn't have anything together. She just didn't have it together. The family finally found relatives of hers in another town nearby, and that was back in Russia when they lived in the shtetls. And they found the family, and they said, yes, send her back to us. We'll take her. She can come and live with us. But Dad wondered all his life about people who were like that, and he saw people like that fairly frequently. He saw people who beat up other people for no reason. He saw people who were angry, and he didn't understand their anger. He saw people who had no sense of humor. And he didn't understand that because he was brought up with a tremendous sense of humor.
So how did he get to Freud? We want to know how.
He found Freud when he was a senior in high school, as I said, and he started reading Freud then. Whatever was available, he could read. He learned German. He was very fluent in German. His native language was Russian, but he was very fluent in English. And in German, he knew a little Italian. He knew a little of other languages. And he read, And he decided early, since he was the founder of psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic study, that that was the person he wanted to go to finish his education on what psychoanalysis ought to, how it ought to be practiced.
Who connected him to him? Did he write him? Did he have an in?
He wrote to him, and Brill held off, because Brill was a great friend of Freud's, but he held off for a while. He didn't write right away. And my dad wrote him several letters that he didn't get an answer to for over a year, and he wondered if he had ever received the letters, and he would write other letters, I want to come to see you and all. Well, in the summer of 1926, that was I was born in the spring that year, and during that summer, my mother's sister was going to come and help her take care of the children. My brother and I was just a baby, and Dad decided that he was going to have to go to Vienna, and he signed up for a couple of classes at the University of Vienna that he wanted to take. And he wrote Freud a letter, I really must come to see you. Please make time for me. Please allow me to meet you just briefly. And Freud finally wrote to him and said, you certainly are persistent. You're you are an American after all, he said. And you're very persistent. And if you insist, and if you can't put that wish behind you, okay. He says, you can come at 5:30 some afternoon. So Dad did. He showed up at 5:30 on the dot one afternoon, and Freud let him in, and they had a long discussion, and Freud liked him. He liked my father because my father was an intellectual, and he understood really from some of the reading what some of the problems were. And he asked about them, and Freud says, we don't know that yet. We don't know that yet. And he became very fond of Dad, and he said, okay, I will take you on for analysis.
So this is 1926.
That was 1926, but he couldn't take him for the analysis until 1928.
So he went home, came home. How long did he stay at that period of time?
Just that summer.
So it was, yeah. But it was still a relatively long period of time.
Yeah, he was there that summer for the courses at the University of Vienna.
Oh, correct. Right. Yeah. So he went back. He went home. And of course, in those days, as everybody should know, you didn't cross by airplane. This is just a very short period of time after Lindbergh's Lindy Hop across the pond.
Right.
So no one flew, and it was on ocean liners. You probably went on the Aquitania or something, or the Mauritania, were the great ships.
Actually, I have the names of the ships that he went on.
So in other words, then he came home. He packed up the family, young Lynn Lehrman. Her brother, what's your brother, Philip?
Howard.
Howard, right. Yeah. And the father's Philip. And your mother, Wanda, who I knew very, very well. I didn't know your father, but I knew Wanda quite well when she lived with you, and she was always a wonderful conversationalist. And unfortunately, as I mentioned to you and talked about, I never knew anything about psychiatry or that who your father was. I wish I would have known. I would have talked to Wanda about it. But so your whole family packed up and moved to Vienna.
Yeah, the whole family went for a year. Freud said, you must come for a year. I don't take a patient for analysis for shorter than at least eight to 10 months. Hmm. And he says, he did shorten some analyses that he held, but that was up to him. And as I said, he got to like my dad, and he liked his dad. He didn't like Americans, actually. He thought Americans were just too wild. And, of course, he was right about that, too. But the problem, really, with Freud at the time was that in 1923 he developed cancer of the jaw. Mm. And all his teeth on one side of his face had to be pulled. And the doctors who worked on him didn't know a whole lot about cancer. They didn't know how to treat it. They hadn't. They didn't have the medications. They had some theories about how this would work better than that. And he was in constant agony. Mm-hmm. And he ceased having the ability to speak very much in public. So his daughter Anna took over. She became an excellent
almost the voice of Freud.
Yeah, the voice of Freud, and. Dad said I could be that in America for you as well. He said I really like the way you think, and I like the way you write, and so that was the beginning.
We're talking to Lynn Lehrman Wiener about her book Freud Through Lehrman's Lens, and this reflects a collection of films made by Philip Lehrman when he studied with Freud through the psychoanalytical program in 1920 and 1929 and took home movies of them that we're going to talk about those home movies. I'm curious how they came about and why did your father, what was your father's interest in home movies? Very few people took movies then. How did he get into that?
Well, he loved photography and he was a good photographer from early on. The simple box camera to him was not a simple box camera. He played games with it and he tested it out in different kinds of lighting, different circumstances, different things, different shadows. So he had an experimental mind, and photography was something that he loved. Camera, movie photography was something very new. And he bought one of the first home movie cameras on sale by Bell and Howell in 1926.
16 millimeter.
And 16 millimeter. And he brought enough film to take with him to Europe. And his aim, right from the beginning, was to take movies of Freud, which had never been done.
Right. We're going to have a little break here. I just want to mention again, this is WVOX Radio, 1460 on your dial. You are listening to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel and his guest Lynn Lehrman-Wiener and her husband John. You can also hear this live streaming on your computer at www.wvox.com. Lynn Lehrman is talking about her book, Sigmund Freud Through Lehrman's Lens, her father, which will be coming out in English very soon. And in the second half of this program, we're going to talk about her adventures in the young state of Israel in 1949 and Operation Magic Carpet. We're going to talk about that.
When the steps get harder, what steps can you take to make them easier? Hip and knee pain have many causes. You can learn about them at Sound Shore Medical Center's free monthly seminars. There are many steps to improvement. Take the first one. Join us. For more information or to reserve a space for the next informative hip and knee pain seminar at Sound Shore Medical Center in New Rochelle, please call 365-4013 today.
Where you going, baby? Summertime is here. Rides galore, a great family deal. Like that spark, get behind the wheel. Everybody's going down to Playland Park. Have some fun.
Some fun today at Playland and more fun at Playland's free concert with Jenny Geiger on Thursday, August 23rd at 8 p.m. Grab your family and friends and get there early Thursday, August 23rd at 8. Teddy Geiger, so close in Rye, New York. Go to www.ryeplayland.org for more information. And remember, Playland is closed Mondays.
Everybody's going down to Playland Park. Have some fun.
Great people, the professionals who care with Bellaway Electrical Contracting in Elmsford, remind us the effects of child abuse are devastating. If you're a parent who's been abused as a child, remember how that left you feeling, helpless and filled with anger. If you're struggling with your temper, get help. Call your family counselor or child abuse hotline today. There's someone out there who cares. This message is from Bellaway Electrical Contracting in Elmsford, where they're doing their part in the fight against child abuse.
Now, there are two in Westchester. Buffalo Wild Wings. Two great new family-friendly restaurants for you and yours. It's like eating with your entire family in an ESPN control room. Both Buffalo Wild Wings have great food with the best wings, wraps, salads, and burgers around. Dine with your friends and family surrounded by more than 50 high-tech TV sets. Sportsmen and their ladies and sportswomen and their guys will enjoy golf, basketball, football, and soccer at Buffalo Wild Wings. All this plus great food in a family-friendly sports environment. There's a Buffalo Wild Wings Grill and Bar in New Rock City with easy parking in the New Rochelle Municipal Garage. And visit the Buffalo Wild Wings in downtown Portchester in the newly developed waterfront section at Westchester and Main, just one block from the train station in the same building as Lowe's Theaters. You're lucky in Westchester with two exciting Buffalo Wild Wings, now in New Rochelle and Portchester. Check out BuffaloWildWings.com. Buffalo Wild Wings. You have to be here.
In the north end of New Rochelle, you'll find an absolutely top-notch printer, one of the very best in the entire county. Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is known for its fine work far beyond the Sound Shore area. In fact, this particular Minuteman Press is easily the class of the fleet when it comes to full-service community printers. Located just off North Avenue in the narrow Waikigill walkway opposite Big Top and across the parking lot from the Food Emporium, Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is a terrific resource for individuals and small to medium-sized companies who want something special when it comes to printing. No matter how big or small your needs, you get great skill and creativity from Maestro Maselli's master printers, all for very reasonable prices. From business cards to brochures, color copies, high-speed printing, informational booklets, and flyers. Minuteman Press, down that walkway across from Big Top when you're heading to the Food Emporium, offers quality printing at very good prices. Call Frank Maselli at Minuteman Press of New Rochelle, 914-576-0335. In Westchester, 576-0335.
What's the easiest way to finish mowing your lawn? Well, starting, of course. Easy to start also means easy to finish. That's why Toro made the SR4 Super Recycler lawnmower. Like all Toro mowers, the SR4 Super Recycler is engineered to start on the first or second pull for the first 5 years, guaranteed. And if for some reason your SR4 Super Recycler doesn't start on the first or second pull, Toro will fix it for free. Take a test pull of an SR4 Super Recycler when you stop by Mario Bulfamante & Sons, 75 Portman Road, New Rochelle today. Toro, count on it. See your Toro dealer for warranty details.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Hi there. Hi there. Hello. Richard Garfunkel, the Advocates, my great guest and friends, the Wieners, Lynn Lehrman Wiener and her husband John Wiener. We're going to move up a bit. We've been talking about her book, Sigmund Freud Through Lehrman's Lenses, meaning Lehrman in the name of Philip Lehrman, famous psychoanalyst who studied with Freud in 1928 and 29, took some remarkable films of Freud at that period, home movies if you could call them. It's interesting. He tried to get Freud to pose for the movies. Freud didn't want it. Lynn had explained earlier that Freud had problems because of numerous operations on his jaw, great pain at cancer of the mouth, probably because of his smoking cigars almost incessantly. That probably
that
had a cause.
Help, yeah.
Didn't help. It was mentioned that the lighting was not easy in those days. He was there in the winter, and he got him to pose looking out the window in the light, etc. Very interesting. And I want to connect up not only Lynn's effort at putting together the Freud films in the period of 1950 or so, actually a little later than that, but also Lynn had a very other unique experience as one could say not a cinematographer, but a person who put together film and experience. And it's interesting that in 1950, just before, actually 1949, just before you had worked with your father on editing all the raw footage of Freud, you had another interesting experience regarding film and your unique trip to Israel and Yemen. Could you tell us a bit about your trip to Israel with John and the Operation Magic Carpet, the Alaskan Airlines, and Captain Robert McGuire? Tell us a bit about that and how you got involved.
Well, I got involved because I'd worked for a newspaper, and I had press coverage, press allowances, and cable privileges. At that time, you sent messages by cable. You didn't do it directly over a phone. Television, of course, was not existent. And we got permission, John too. John got permission from the New York Post to send in whatever cables news might be of interest to them. And I had permission from the Journal American to do it there. We knew about some of the things going on from friends that we had who lived there and friends who became friends as we got to know them in Israel. And there was no question that there were operations going on to bring in Jewish civilians from many parts of the Near East who were living in countries dominated by Arabs, Their life was not an easy life, and they, once they heard about Israel, they wanted to get there, but they didn't know how. They needed permission from the country they were in to leave, which many of them didn't get, and they needed some way to get to Israel. Some of the Jews from Yemen actually walked. They walked hundreds of miles over the border and got there in the late 1800s. But the massive amount of Jews who lived there, many of them had very good work. They were long established. They had lived there for 1,000 or more years, some of them, and they had a life. We knew about the operation, but we didn't know how it worked and who was in charge and what was going on from day to day. Well, Don and I were staying in a hotel in Tel Aviv. It happened to end up to be the headquarters of the Near East Air Transport, which we didn't know at the time. And we went into the dining room to have a cup of coffee and a sandwich, and there were three guys sitting at a table right next to us, and I was trying to listen to their conversation because I'm very nosy. And I heard them speaking about the next time we go, we're bringing back potatoes. Well, I knew that potatoes were they were just almost non-existent in Israel. It had a lot of vegetables. It grew a lot of greens. But potatoes were hard to come by. And when I heard potatoes, I said to John, I have to ask these guys where they're going to get potatoes.
Idaho, maybe.
So I got up from my chair and I went over to the table. I introduced myself and I said, do you people have anything to do with Operation Magic Carpet? He says, yeah, that's who we are.
Oh, wow. And so, just to frame that, so the audience knows, Operation Magic Carpet was led by World War II pilot Robert McGuire. Israel sponsored 380 flights to Yemen over a 1,400-mile trip over hostile Arab territory and rescued between 40 and 50,000 Yemenite Jews. So you got on that one, those flights.
Yes. Well, I said to him, you know, we've been to the Arab office, the Emirate office. They said there was no such thing going on. We went to the British office. They said there was no such thing going on that we know of. We couldn't go to the Jewish office because it was a Saturday and they closed. But everybody we spoke to said, don't try to speak to any official about this. They're not going to give you any information. And having been a pretty well-trained newspaper woman, I said, there is something else going on here and I'm going to have to learn what it is. But these three guys said, come on over and sit down and bring your husband. Is that your husband? Yes. Okay, bring him over and sit down. So we all sat together at the table, and I said, how do I find out more about what's going on Operation Magic Carpet? He says, you get on a plane with us, and we'll show you what's going on. And I said, how do we do that? He says, we'll sign you on as members of the crew. Well, that's exactly what they did. They said they were leaving that night at 11 o'clock. We should meet them at a particular place at the hotel. They would take us out with a limousine car that they had that was driving them to Lida Airport. And they would just say, this is part of our crew, and, you know, we would get on the plane and we'd go.
What were these, DC-6s or DC-3s?
DC-4s.
DC-4s, yeah. They were four-engine planes.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, the first of the DC-4 planes.
How many people could sit? Did they cram in those things?
We stuck back with us with 120.
Oh, so
but I think it's 60 or 70
capacity.
But what
they did was they took out all the seats.
Yeah. Sure.
And they put in benches across the back because they wanted to fit in as many people as they could. The Yemenites had been through a history of being undernourished, and they were very small people. Mm. They were short, they were thin, they were very light, and I think the average man didn't weigh more than maybe 80 or 90 pounds. Wow.
And without fear. They got on a plane, as you can see in the movie that Lynn took, that they were fearless at all. And, of course, that was because they were fulfilling a biblical
prophecy
that they would be born on the wings of eagles to the free land. In fact, they were so relaxed that one day one of the pilots smell of smoke went back, and they had built a little fire
on the floor
and were making coffee with that little Dijon.
They were roasting beetles.
I don't think that would be tolerated today.
No,
you can hardly smoke. You can go into a bathroom. Let me ask you. So you had a camera with you?
Oh, of course. I had three cameras.
What were the cameras?
I had the Bell and Howell. My father gave me the Bell and Howell, the movie camera. And I had two still cameras. I had a Leica and a Rolly.
Now, those Bell and Howells had different lenses you could rotate.
Yes.
I know. I used even one in 1960.
Well, I didn't. I didn't take any extra lenses with me. I didn't want to have to fiddle with that. And it was very difficult for me to handle the three cameras. And I had extra lenses with the still cameras. So
you were the only person that has ever taken films of this historic and unprecedented event?
Not quite so.
Okay.
We were the only people who took it in color film.
And also to the extent that we did.
But our friend Ruth Gruber, who also had done a lot of work in Israel and was a reporter and a newspaper woman and is still alive, to my knowledge.
She's about 100 years old.
At least. A fabulous person. And we became very good friends. And she took some films in black and white, but not on the plane. She was never on the plane.
Ruth Gruber, of course, to preface, is an incredibly famous woman who rescued many Jews from Italy in the Second World War, was appointed...
Thousands of children.
Was commissioned almost as a brigadier general by the Army through Harold Ickes. Remarkable woman, written about 16 or 17 books, was the youngest PhD, woman PhD in America. Still alive, still very famous. She's around. She talks. We saw her at the Museum of the City, New York, last year. She's a remarkable person. She's really somebody to talk about. What happened to these films of the Yemenite Operation Magic Carpet?
Well, I figured I had the story of the century, of course, and that we were going to put that together. And I wired my editor, and I said, I have these films. And he said, send the films and send your work with it. And I said, I'm not going to send the films. I will come back with them. I didn't want them out of my hands. And then I discovered that some official took John and me aside and said, look, this is a secret operation. You cannot speak about it. You cannot speak openly about it. This is a secret operation. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I looked him square in the eyes, and he was not fooling.
Right.
It was like he was going to arrest us if we opened our mouths and spoke about it. I said, well, we took the trip, we took the movies, what do I do with them? He says, take them home.
Right.
And please do us the favor, he was an Israeli official, please do us the favor of keeping this secret. He said, if our enemies find out the
extent of what's going on.
Not only the extent, but the schedules that we have for these planes leaving and coming back, they may be able to leave, but they may not be ever get back.
Right.
And they're all coming back loaded with people from not just Yemen, but from all over the Middle East. They went to Iraq. They went into Syria. They got permission to go all over because they were American pilots.
Right.
And Bob McGuire was a phenomenal guy that we got to know well. He was 39 years old at the time, and we stayed in touch with him for many years. We wrote letters, and we wrote letters to Dan McLean and Herb Stiles, who were the co-pilot and the engineer. And going down to Aden, which was where we went to get the Yemenite Jews, because they had to get into Aden. We couldn't go into Yemen. And they were escorted into a camp where they were examined, and doctors said, these people may go, but those people cannot. They have things that health problems that we have to first...
But they didn't separate the families. As the anticlimax of that is many years later, just, what was it, 2 years ago, we discovered who Bob McGuire was. He came from the McGuire real estate family in Los Angeles, who owned about half of Los Angeles or more. They're the biggest. They were the Trumps of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And when he died, Robert McGuire, the pilot, Lynn wrote a letter to his father and told what I wanted. And he invited Lynn to come and spoke at his
memorial,
which was done at the airport with the missing flight going over and with one of the DC-4s landing, and it was very emotional, and Lynn was the main speaker. So it was a fitting climax to that, what I called a biblical experience, because it was actually more spectacular than what Moses did. Moses just went through a swamp and took the Jews.
Took him
40 years, and we flew over Mount Sinai, down the Red Sea, picked up 120 Yemenites and flew them back to freedom. That was spectacular.
David Ben-Gurion called him the Irish Moses. And Leon Uris, in his famous novel Exodus, based a character upon him. He died a year or so ago at 94, and there was a lot of coverage about him, etc. Again, let me just remind our audience, this is WVOX Radio 1460 on your dial. You're listening to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel and his guests, Lynn Lehrman-Wiener and her husband, John. You can also hear this live streaming on your computer, www.wvox.com. Lynn Lehrman is talking about her book, Sigmund Freud Through Lehrman's Lens, which will be coming out in English, and she's also discussing her adventures in the State of Israel and Operation Magic Carpet. Lynn, how did this... your book on Freud, which was, and your father's film work, etc., which was published in German and now will be coming out in English, which I recommend everybody look for, ask for, and buy. How did this come about? And, you know, how did you identify these people in these films? And where were these films? You know, where were they? Where were they stored?
Well, we owned the films. My father left them actually in my care because I had helped him to do some editing on them before he died. And we had made a 20-minute film together. And it didn't come out properly. But at that time, the Freud Archives was being established. And they asked Ed to let them have a copy for the archives. And he said, I'll give it to you on a proviso. If my daughter and I can ever make this film properly and get out the mistakes that were made with the 20-minute version, I want that version back because it's too full of mistakes. And my father was a perfectionist, and he just couldn't stand that idea. Yeah. Well, many years later, after Dad died, I tried to get the films back, and I had a small battle to get them back. But finally I did, and... I was able to get a grant, fortunately, from the New Land Foundation, which was a new foundation that was sponsoring many things that had to do with psychoanalysis, but also many writings that people couldn't do because they needed a secretary or whatever they needed, and New Land was giving money to those projects. When they heard about my film, they said, we will absolutely give you a grant for it, and... I wasn't sure how much to ask for. I thought I had done a good job doing my homework, but it was not sufficient. And John and I had to part with a lot of money in addition. But that was not what was important. What was important that it be an historically accurate document, and that was what was chief in my mind. So at this point, it is a historically accurate document. I made it into a documentary, and I've been three-quarters of the way around the world and back showing it to various groups that invited me and paid expenses, etc. And but as I was working on the documentary, I was also, I say it's 5 years, but it was probably closer to 10 years of research to find out who all the people's names were. I knew a good many of the names. I knew them in person, some of them. But I didn't know them all. And unfortunately, my father did not write them all down. And especially groups like the French psychoanalytic group, he never did get all the names down. So it took quite a bit of sending. I had to make still copies from the movies. And I sent them literally around the world, wherever I had a lead, sent it to this one, sent it to that one. I sent them to China, I sent them to Japan, to Russia, I sent them all over Europe, and I sent them all over the United States. And in time, they came back to me and they said, yes, this is so-and-so, or I am sure that this is so-and-so. And little by little, I put together all but two of the faces of 109 faces that I have in the film.
Wow. Apropos of that, there was also some other film depictions of Freud by Marie Bonaparte. Was she a relative of the Bonapartes?
Yes, she was a grandniece of Napoleon's, and her great uncle was his brother, Lucien.
Oh.
And she had inherited her father's great wealth. He was the one who established the casino at Monte Carlo. Hmm. And so he had a few bucks.
Yeah. So,
francs.
So she and Ruth Brunswick had friends of the Freuds, and they also did film. And for their own private reasons,
they took them later, though, than Dad did. Actually, the story about my father taking the movies, he continuously asked Freud every time he went to see him, may I just take a few shots of you? The sun is out, and if you stand by the window, I'll get... And he said, Freud finally turned to him, and he said, listen, remember my words. Don't remember my face.
Right.
And it was not that he was camera shy. It was that he felt that the camera froze your image. And because his face was quite distorted by that time after some 30, 40 surgeries, it was not a question of ego, I'm sure. It was a question of the fact that he was just not comfortable being photographed, and he begged my father not to, and my father kept asking him anyway, and finally he said, listen, I've been looking for a neuroticism. We have to start with something neurotic. That is neurotic, that you continuously ask me to photograph me when I continuously tell you I will not be photographed.
So when
it's analyzed, he says, then you can take pictures.
So Freud discovered your father's neurosis.
Exactly.
All right, the question is, a quick answer on what happened to her films? What happened to their films?
Well,
did you get your hands on them?
Well, I, as a matter of fact, have copies of them, but they're just for my private world, and I take editing or any
So those were those never were in your documentary.
But they exist, and they have been edited, and they have been put together in London when Anna and the family left for London in 1938. That was the one thing that she made sure that she had. She left a copy with Dr. Eichhorn, August Eichhorn, who was a psychoanalyst, and he had no fear of staying because he was not Jewish, and he said he will guard the films, and he did. He took many of Freud's most precious books, and he said, when the war is over, I'll send them to you. But
yeah. Let me frame this, of course, for our audience. Freud was a very famous personage in Vienna up until the late 1930s. When the Nazis took control of Germany, obviously they had taken it in the early 30s, even though he had been awarded by Germany in 1930 the prestigious Goethe Prize for his contribution to psychology and German literary culture, the Nazis soon burned his books, and when they took control, we all know what happened. Austrians were no less anti-Semitic, and after the Anschluss, which was the union, we could call it forced or voluntary unification of Germany and Austria in 1938, Freud and his family became threatened by the Gestapo. They eventually escaped and traveled to London. I have a couple of questions on this. Did your father stay? We don't have a lot of time. Did your father stay in contact with Freud during those dangerous and threatening years?
Yes, there were many letters between them that are published in the book. And I am looking forward to those coming out. It's the first time they will ever be published. On the films, it was just Marie actually rescued Freud. She paid the Nazis an enormous
ransom right.
And got him out. And whole family was able to leave.
So you have the original. Were they typed, most of the letters from Freud, from someone else, and he signed them?
No. If he typed them, then he typed them. Many of them he hand wrote, and we had to discern his handwriting.
Some in English and some in German.
Some were in English and some were in German, but the Germans they've all been translated.
I have a quick question because we're running down in time, and I want to make sure it gets in. The we've noticed, and you have told me before, that the Austrians are very, very interested in Freud after these many years, and you were very welcomed there. Could you say, or could I say, is it guilt you feel? Is this part of it, over the treatment of the Jews and the rejection of one of their most famous sons? In other words, or is this just another way to create a tourist landmark? We have a few minutes. What do you think on this? You're very experienced.
Well, I really don't. I think that a lot of people are guilty around the world for many things that they do. But I think what happened was that when Freud left, he was an internationally known person of some merit. Mm. And I think that they felt that, of course, he had not been treated right. And there was a group that took over his early apartment on Berghassa Street, and they turned it into a museum.
Hmm.
And it's a fabulous museum. It's where they showed my film every day, every hour of every day for 9 months. And I had a complete exhibit on all the people who were in the film and what they wrote and who they were and where they came from. And it was an astounding
exhibit.
What?
It was an astounding exhibit.
It was more than an exhibit, because it was a very, for me, a very personal thing.
They've really come back to Freud as their native son, in a sense. They've come back to understand him. Of course, we know Freud as an incredibly controversial individual. His teaching's controversial. Right. It's still being debated every day in the medical halls of psychoanalysis. Does it work? Doesn't it work? Many psychiatrists use chemicals and medicines today. I want to thank Lynn Lehrman Wiener, the author of Sigmund Freud Through Lehrman's Lens, a book about her father's films and experience with Freud. John Wiener, of course, her husband. They talked about their trip to Israel, the incredible Operation Magic Carpet, which rescued 40 to 50,000 Yemenite Jews, an ancient community that resided in Yemen in the up until the post-Israeli revolution, if you want to, or fight for freedom in 19 and establishment of the state. Of course, this is Richard Garfunkel and the Advocates. It's a pleasure to be on. It's always a pleasure to be on with excellent guests. We could have talked about this, I'm pretty sure, for a couple more hours. And I'm hoping to have Lynn Lehrman and Wiener and her husband John coming back, talk a little bit. Maybe we'll talk about the Catskills. John Wiener is...
You bet. One of the most neglected historical parts of America.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Maybe the next time around, when they're back from Arizona, we're going to talk about the Catskill Mountains and what happened to them. Are they still there? Bye-bye.